All right, let's go ahead and get started. We'll keep an eye on the waiting room and allow others to enter when it's time. But again, I'm Jennifer Bosley. I'm glad you're here with us today. I'm Director of Learning and Collaboration here at the Health Plan Alliance. As we like to say, we work for you. We are excited about today's presentation that will focus on early cancer detection. But before we get started and I introduce the speaker, just a few helpful housekeeping tips that we like to go over just to ensure that you get the most out of this call. So first of all, want to let you know that we are recording this session. And it will be available on the website under this event, under the Documents tab. So we're super happy to be able to make that available to you. Also, this session today is designed to be interactive. So the speaker, Dr. Lance Baldo, encourages us to come off mute and share your thoughts and ask your questions. If you're a little shy and don't want to come off mute, you can certainly use the chat function. I'll be monitoring chat and interjecting along the way, but let's be informal and let's get the most out of this discussion by opening up and talking or asking questions if you have a desire to. So that's how our events work. The more interaction and collaboration we have, all the better. And the last little tip is that, as always, we do a quick survey at the end of the event, and we want to get your feedback and also get your ideas for future topics for next year. We're planning for next year. So please take a moment to do that quick survey at the end. Tori will post that link for us. And I see some more folks have joined us. I'm trying to keep an eye on as they come in. And we're just so happy that you're here today. Again, I want to encourage you guys to share your thoughts and questions along the way. All right, let's kick things off. We're so happy to have Freenome back. They participated in one of our meetings earlier this year and with great success. And we felt like that this topic, early cancer detection, warrants continued discussion. I know that all of you all are focusing heavily on your high-cost treatments. And of course, cancer is one of those that takes a lot of energy and focus. And so we are in continuous search to enable you guys to make smarter decisions and to delve into the right technologies and solutions that enable you guys to control costs and deliver better outcomes. So Freenome today will be presenting. Dr. Lance Baldo is Chief Medical Officer there at Freenome, and he will be presenter. And then he is joined by a couple of other colleagues who will engage as well. So Lance, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Great, thanks. And as Jennifer knows, I'm working from Florida right now. After a medical meeting on the East Coast, I flew down to check on my parents, who unfortunately were in the path of Hurricane Ian. They're doing fine, but there is a lot of cleanup going on. I have the window open, and there's like utility trucks going down the road and garbage pickup trucks. So please, Jennifer, if you hear a lot of background noise, I can go shut the window. I'd prefer it to be open because I get a breeze, but if the noise gets to be too much, please tell
I will
me.
let you know.
All
Okay.
right, cool. Great. As already mentioned, my name's Lance Baldo. I'm the Chief Medical Officer here at Adaptive. I'm a surgeon by training, orthopedic surgeon. Please don't hold that against me. But I've been working in biotechnology for a long time now, about 20 years. Everything from research and development in the pharmaceutical space to more recently in vitro diagnostics. And then specifically now with Freenome, working on risk prediction and early cancer detection. And what we're going to talk about today is a pretty heavy focus on risk prediction and how we might be able to work together to be able to leverage data unique to you and your covered lives to be able to do better to figure out how to use your precious resources. But we're also going to start by talking a little bit about cancer detection, which is probably even the bigger challenge that I have as the Chief Medical Officer here and where I spend the majority of my time. So this is what it's going to look like real quickly. And I really do, I speak relatively fast. because I'm from the Northeast and it was just a thing. So I'm going to take it pretty slow, but I can't see who's asking questions. So just chime in. I won't at all feel bad if you're interrupting me. Jennifer is also going to help me out in that respect as well. We're going to cover a little bit about FreeNome, a little bit about why early detection matters, why we've started with colorectal cancer as our index approach, a bit about risk prediction, a touch on primary care, and then looking ahead about how we might be able to work together and partner together. So a little bit about FreeNome. First, I'm going to start with a video, and this worked when we tested it not 20 minutes ago. So I'm just going to be quiet for a second and start the video, and hopefully it'll work for you. Just give me 1 second. I promise it's a very brief, less than 1 minute.
FreeNome is a company that's working on a blood test for early cancer detection.
So we can be able to look at blood and be able to catch cancers early so we can attack it while it's still in its infancy.
For me, the competitor is cancer. First competitor is colorectal cancer, but we're not stopping there.
The foundation that we're building is really the combination of these two platforms, the multiomics platform that analyzes the blood, and then the artificial intelligence that helps us then detect those patterns of disease.
One of the first times in human history where we can bring together all these different technologies to be able to address this big problem. I really think that cancer can be a solved problem in our lifetimes.
I even let the dramatic music play for an extra few seconds there at the end just to get the full effect. But really exciting, in my opinion, what we're doing here at FreeNome. And identifying cancer early is a really hard problem. It's a tractable problem, but it's a very hard problem. And as Jimmy Lin, my colleague and chief scientific officer, pointed out, we're really at a point in history where a confluence of things is happening that's allowing us to be able to do this. One is the technologies have advanced to a point where they're actually useful and meaningful in this application. The other is that their costs have come down quite a bit. I'd like for them to come down more, for instance, next generation sequencing, but the cost has come down to where you could actually think about using these tests in a screening or surveillance type approach. The other thing is just what we've learned about biology and chemistry has come such a long way. And the third thing also, as Jimmy mentioned, was this machine learning, artificial intelligence, where we can take an amount of data that before we wouldn't even know what to do with, and with cloud computing and applying machine learning to it, we could actually make sense of what would otherwise be noise. And so the primary product that we're building is a test initially for CRC cancer and eventually for multiple cancers to be able to identify those cancers early using a standard blood draw, meaning a single tube of blood ideally, and typical venipuncture, nothing special, nothing specific. And our mission here at FreeNome is to create tools that empower everyone to prevent, detect, and treat disease. And that really fits in not with the early cancer screening test, but also with the risk prediction that we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about today. The company was incorporated, I'm relatively new, I've been here about 6 months now, but the company was incorporated way back in 2014 when our founders won a $700,000 Verizon Powerful Answers grant to basically get the company started. As mentioned, we're based in the Bay Area. The company is actually at Oyster Point, South San Francisco. We have about 500 employees and a number of really important clinical studies that either have run or are running. AI Emerge, which is a historical study, Preempt CRC, which is fully completed enrollment and will be reading out next year as well. And that's a CRC study as evidenced by its name, as well as two multi-cancer studies now called Volania and Sanderson, which we won't be covering today, but these are intended to provide data for discovery, ultimately development, and then validation of a multi-cancer product or products. And we have some really amazing and committed and passionate partners and investors. So everyone from Novartis, Roche, Anthem, Kaiser, Intermountain, people that don't just care about innovation, but care about bringing innovation to be able to benefit patients and benefit society. And so I feel pretty privileged that we have the backing of so many powerful and so many influential groups. And, what they say, timing is everything. Cancer is really at the forefront right now, including with the Biden and the cancer moonshot. In fact, when President Biden spoke in Boston, probably coming up about 6 weeks ago now, in the past, when they talked about the cancer moonshot, it was all about treatment. And this idea of detection was pretty much absent. You've almost seen a flip-flop this time where he very specifically said, and that's not going to be an exact quote, he said, imagine going to the doctor in the future and they draw off a standard vial of blood and we're able to find cancer in that blood. So you even have the president talking about this idea as well. And also hard to see in the picture, but our CEO and one of our co-founders is in this picture as well. We've been invited down to DC to start getting together and just talking about how we can work together to, as Mike says, compete with the thing here that really matters, and that's colorectal cancer. How's the background noise? It's pretty loud for me.
We're hearing a little bit of background noise.
Give me 1 second. I'm just going to shut the window. Give me 1 second. I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
While he does that, I'll just take a moment to ask if you've perhaps seen those recent studies about the effectiveness of colonoscopies. Thought it was incredible timing with this discussion. So anyway.
Sorry, I'm back, Tracy. I heard the end of that. You're talking to the Nordic study that just came out.
Yeah.
So interesting. Yeah, not surprisingly, we've had a lot of time to think about that. Our investors asked us a lot about that. And you shouldn't discount any study in my mind, especially one that was thoughtfully designed and executed. But there are some pretty significant limitations of that study, including, as you probably know, they invited people to be screened by colonoscopy. And the vast minority of people actually chose to get screened by colonoscopy. And the ones that actually did get screened did see benefits in terms of reduced incidence of CRC screening. The other thing I just found out recently, because I was at ACG, only 30 of the GI docs involved in that study actually did more than 30, or maybe it's 20 of the colonoscopies. Most did 1, 2, or 3, because colonoscopy is not widely done in these. And so you have to imagine that there's some operator variability in terms of the quality of their ability to, you know, detect and intervene on those cancers as well. So I don't think, and I'd love to hear your view, Tracy, I don't think this should change the way we do things in the US. But, you know, I don't also think you shouldn't discount the results of a prospective and quite large clinical study as well. But I'd love to hear what you think, Tracy. Any thoughts from your perspective?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I don't know if I've looked at the details as much as you have, and I don't want to, you know, sort of usurp your time here. But I think, you know, what I took away from reading it was that, there was some component of mortality that I think they determined was not decreased. But if you think about whether or not you want to prevent colon cancer or treat colon cancer, that was one area where they said there was clearly a role for colonoscopies in prevention. So to me, I felt like that was that was profound, right? That matters. I mean, certainly if you can avoid treatment, chemotherapy, surgery, then you want to do that. Yeah.
Well put. Well put. Yeah. Well, thanks for the comment and the question. Yeah, I think it's really, really timely with everything else going on as well. So getting back in, and literally there's like 5 trucks on the road now doing repairs to the utilities. It was pretty devastated here in Southwest Florida. So it's glad to see that they're really coming together quickly to try to get the community put back together. But so apologize for the background noise, but we'll get back on with it again. As mentioned, you know, we had a chance to go down to the White House and really talk about with this current administration about how we're going to work together to really make a dent, particularly in early cancer detection. You know, we put together a pretty strong team here. I'm biased, I'm on that team, but put together a pretty strong team to try to do this here at Freenome across many different disciplines, people that have worked in healthcare administration. Our head of regulatory was the deputy commissioner at the FDA. We have people that come from pharma. We have people that come from genomics. And so just trying to, almost like our product takes you know, so many disciplines for our product to work, we try to take people from lots of different disciplines as well to try to solve this, what is ultimately going to be a tractable problem. And as Tracy kind of pointed out, really apropos for the Nordic study, it really starts with early detection. And I'm going to speak to that a little bit in the context of some of the science and our approach here. I apologize. I know there's a very technically savvy group, but you know, later stage cancers in particular tend to lyse a lot more, and they tend to release a lot more of their DNA, RNA, and proteins. And this is the idea of a tumor-derived signal. And maybe not surprisingly, it's fairly easy in a sample of blood to pick up a stage 4 tumor. But we also know once it's a stage 4 tumor, and I'm going to show you some data on this in a second, first of all, the patient outcomes are not going to be as good, and the cost to manage and treat those patients become really extreme. So the holy grail here in my mind is to be able to pick up cancers earlier, stage 3, stage 2, stage 1, etc. The problem is that some of these earlier stage cancers, they just simply don't lyse as much. They're not releasing as much of their, for instance, genetic material into the bloodstream, and it gets a bit harder to pick up that signal. And so what we do, and we take an approach that's called multi-omics. So we look at not just genetics or genomics, we also look at many other things. In the case of CRC, we're looking at proteomics. And so whereas an earlier stage tumor may not release a lot of nucleic acid, they tend to release quite a bit of protein, and they kind of change what would be termed the tumor milieu. So the area around that tumor starts to change, and some of those chemicals get released into the bloodstream. And those are the analytes that we're looking at in addition to genetics when we look at our multi-omics test. And early detection impacts outcomes. I mean, again, I keep calling on Tracy, you're still on my screen here. I mean, that's kind of the point of the Nordic study as well, whereas if you do get the screening modality and you do pick it up early, you can have less expensive care and better outcomes. And we've seen this pretty much across every cancer. And it's very profound, thankfully, in the screen cancers, prostate, breast, and of course, colon cancer as well. And so in this very simple table, it shows, you know, how much better survival can be over 4 years if you pick it up when it's localized versus when it's already metastasized. I think this is pretty obvious, but I'll say it anyway. So if we could increase CRC screening adherence by any mechanism, by the way, outreach, risk prediction, making it easier, more convenient, we could collectively deliver better quality, better clinical outcomes, and cost savings. And we want to prove some of that. And I think one of the discussions which we'd love to have you with you at some point as potential partners in the future is that we want to kind of put our proverbial money where our mouth is. Like, we want to demonstrate not that we can actually create these tools to identify the people that may be at higher risk, but that there's downstream benefits of that as well, to be able to show that patients are doing better, to be able to show that the total cost of care, for instance, can be brought down. And this is a really interesting analysis, and I'm going to be sharing, we'll be sharing these slides for the website afterwards, so you'll be able to look at the link down at the bottom. This is a really interesting analysis coming out of the SEER Medicare database that looked at the CRC attributable costs for Medicare members. And the first part of this, in the first 12 months of diagnosis, were pretty obvious. In fact, even the authors expected this to be true. Not surprisingly, and again, this is CRC attributable costs. Not surprisingly, when you catch cancers early, the total cost of care in the first 12 months is considerably less than when you catch it late. And that was pretty, I think that was pretty obvious to most people that that was going to be the case. But interestingly, the interim period, so in other words, annualized cost was much greater for those that are captured later. And even in the last 12 months before death, which you'd think you'd have relatively similar costs in those last 12 months, which tend to be much more fulminant in terms of disease, it still was less expensive for the tumors, the cancers that were caught a lot earlier. So not only does catching cancer earlier potentially, and if not certainly, benefit patients and the early cost of care, it might also, according to this analysis, decrease the total cost of care over lifetime, essentially, as well. So just really interesting analysis, and I encourage you to read it in the GNCI Monographs 2020. The first blood test, as I've mentioned multiple times now, is focused on detecting CRC and advanced adenoma. So, you know, the precursor of more advanced cancers. Then you might ask the question, why CRC? And there's dozens of different cancers for which, you know, there's a huge unmet need. And one of the reasons for that is that it is a very common cancer. Depending on which data set you look at globally, it is the, you know, third, sometimes fourth, but third most common cause of cancer and the second deadliest. And we know from multiple studies that early detection dramatically can increase survival rates, although of course we did not see that in the recent study that came out of the Nordic country. But the 5-year survival rate we know is 90% if we detect it at stage 1, but only 15% if detected at stage 4. And the current approaches, I feel like I'm probably preaching to the choir here, are either colonoscopy, less so sigmoidoscopy here in the US, and then stool-based tests that include either FIT tests or FIT DNA tests like Cologuard. So those are kind of the tools that we have right now in our armamentarium. Unfortunately, though, despite having fairly widespread availability of colonoscopies and these other approaches as well, and pretty good public awareness campaigns, I mean, this was definitely dramatically affected by the pandemic, but screening rates still aren't reaching the prescribed goals, the targets of 80%. And that doesn't even include the fact that the USPSTF, now decreased the screening age to include those patients, those people from 45 to 49 years old as well. So when you include that group who's been, you know, just now made a screening available to them, that number drops down even more. And so, you know, this is really an opportunity that we have collectively, both as those that provide care, as well as those of us that are, you know, trying to innovate in ways to provide more tools for you to be more effective at doing your work and performing your missions. So, as I just mentioned, the USPSTF recommends screening for CRC in all adults for average risk from 45 to 75, and that's in a good way that has implications for coverage mandates. Colonoscopies are known to be effective, again, notwithstanding the recent data that came out of the Nordic study. However, there's a huge backlog for colonoscopy resources, and we know from talking to one of our partners, an academic center on the East Coast, they had a backlog of 2,000 eligible people for whom they had to get colonoscopy. You know, they're expecting it's going to take months, maybe even years to be able to get to their backlog. And so when you hear me talk about risk prediction or risk stratification, I want to make it very clear that everyone that meets screening criteria should be screened. But if any of you are anything like some of the partners we're talking to, you know, you're dealing with resource constraints, capacity constraints, and sometimes even coming out of the pandemic, a backlog as well. And so, number one, a more accessible screening option could allow us to screen more people, i.e. a stool-based or a blood-based approach. And the other is, if we could risk stratify or risk predict, can we make sure that our outreach gets to the patients, gets to the people that are most likely to benefit by finding those that are more likely to have cancer in, let's say, a 2-year time frame? And we're going to get into that in a while when we start talking about our risk prediction. I'll just build this slide. So our objectives are try to make screening easier. And the way that we're doing that from our R&D efforts on the product side are creating an accurate and accessible blood test. And when we say accessible, I'll talk about a little while about how we designed and conducted our studies to make sure that we get broad representation in our study that reflects the actual population of the US. We also hope to be able to increase CRC screening adherence because it will be easier to be screened, and also by using risk prediction in select settings to be able to get the people to the screening whom will benefit the most. And then ultimately, with an aspiration to improve survival rates and outcomes with an accurate and accessible blood test. So this is a study, a very large study. It's probably, if not certainly, the largest ever blood-based study looking at colorectal cancer screening. It's also incredibly diverse, and we're going to talk about that again just in a second. So this is the study. It's over 40,000 subjects that enrolled over a period of about 3 years to be able to look at an average risk population and get a blinded look, a controlled look, to see if whether or not our blood tests can actually pick up cancer and how well it performs in terms of what we call clinical performance, which is a measure of sensitivity and specificity. As I mentioned prior, while the study is completed enrollment, we're doing data cleaning, data scrubbing right now. We'll be locking the database pretty imminently and then reading out top line next year. So we'll have the results of this pre-empt CRC study next year. And it's where I spend a lot of my time right now. Here, the slide says greater than 35,000, which is true. There's many greater than 35,000 participants. We enrolled participants from 45 to 85 years old. These were average risk, so it was not enriched for people with colorectal cancer, so a true average risk screening population. But we really focused on trying to get diverse enrollment by looking at historically Black colleges and universities, as well as federally qualified health centers, to make sure that we had great representation of people that are often neglected in the screening setting. And in fact, enrollment to date, when this snapshot was done, which is a number of months ago now, there were 11.3% of patients, or subjects rather, that were Black or African American, and over 10% which were Hispanic, which is much greater than you see in what you often see reported as the typical breakdown or constituents within a randomized clinical trial. We had over 200 sites in the US mostly, and as already mentioned, working with HBCUs and federally qualified health centers, including Morehouse, and partnerships with groups that are out there on the front lines trying to make sure that patients get screened, Colorectal Cancer Alliance being one of them. We also were already planning to, but then forced to do some additional innovation in the setting of COVID. I mean, this study launched, unfortunately, in March of 2020, where essentially the entire healthcare world shut, as we knew it, kind of shut down. So we continued with traditional recruitment, but we also enabled virtual recruitment. So subjects could enroll from any zip code in the US. We can do almost all the data collection either online or over the phone. And we would literally send a mobile phlebotomist out to them to get a sample of that blood and be able to allow them to participate in the test. And so that what we call hybrid recruitment enabled participation from every single state in the US. So that's pretty uncommon for a study even of this size to be able to get subjects from every single state in the continental US. So I'm going to pause just for a second. So this is a little bit about the company, a little bit about early cancer detection and the multi-omics approach that we're taking, and just a touch on CRC, why we're going after CRC as kind of the first application of this technology, and then also our PREEMPT study, which is going to be the pivotal clinical validation study for colorectal cancer. I'm going to pause for a second just to see if there's any comments or questions.
So what are your thoughts with what you've heard so far? Anything resonate? Any questions you have for Lance? Come off mute and ask.
I'll just say I certainly can relate to the backlog situation. Those issues are real. Resources seem to be scarce and growing even more difficult to sort of get to for our members here in Northern Nevada. So. I find that sort of one of the most compelling parts of what you all are doing is the ability to sort of do this on more of a mass scale, right? Colonoscopies are cumbersome. You know, some people really dislike them. There are a lot of ways that it seems like you're able to simplify and streamline the process of screening.
Yeah, great. I mean, yeah, I would also point, you said everything right about colonoscopy, and then and some people probably just don't need them, you know, and there's other people that would benefit more from a colonoscopy, notwithstanding the cost and the inconvenience and the discomfort, et cetera. But thanks, Tracy.
Anybody else? Any other comments or questions? I want to pause just a second.
With certainty.
Just make sure. Okay.
Great. I'm going to move relatively quick. I want to make sure we have plenty of time for risk prediction, but
gotcha.
A little bit about the pipeline that we're working through as well. So colon cancer, as we mentioned, is really our opportunity to first test this multi-omics platform, and then we could extend that same platform, that same technology to additional cancers as well. And again, I'll go relatively quickly for this, but by taking a methylation signal, which is indicated here on the right, and adding that to a fairly well-established protein marker within prostate cancer, we get something called additivity. So each one on its own doesn't have particularly good performance, but when we look at the two together, what we call additivity, you can get pretty good sensitivity in terms of picking up prostate cancer. So again, these are really early data, but to demonstrate that we can move beyond colorectal cancer to other cancers for which early screening, it's pancreatic cancer, I think I might have said prostate, to pancreatic cancer, to be able to pick up the disease early. And one size doesn't fit all in these particular cancers. Having a false positive in the setting of colorectal cancer, while not good, may not be devastating. Having a false positive in ovarian cancer, when the definitive diagnostic confirmation is a biopsy or surgery, you know, you really want to minimize those false positives. So we don't think about cancer detection in terms of one size fits all. We think that each individual test, you have to tune those performance characteristics for that particular type of cancer as well. And so we don't believe, and there's a number of companies now that are taking approach and more of a one size fits all approach. That's not the Freenome approach. Freenome approach is quite different. It's thoughtful, and it's really tailored for the individual characteristics of that cancer, and also the way that it's definitively diagnosed and then ultimately treated. And now we're getting into the meat of what we're talking about today. And that's like, how do you actually drive adherence? And as Tracy mentioned, how do you get to some of those backlogs that you may be experiencing right now? So what we do with risk prediction is we use EHRs, or frankly, any other source of data. But in the case of partnering with the folks on this call, it would almost certainly be primarily electronic health record data. And then we used advanced modeling and machine learning to figure out, based on your data, and this is what makes it so exciting. This is not a model that was built somewhere and we take that model and we just say, hey, you know, go ahead and apply this without actually looking at your own data. Take your data and use that to model to figure out who's going to face, likely to face CRC in the next 2 years. And the reason why we use a two-year horizon is that theoretically, those are subjects who might be, or patients who might get cancer in a fairly near-term period of time, but also for whom early intervention is more likely to make a difference. Because if you're predicting someone who's going to get cancer in the next 15 years, that's not particularly helpful, because when you go in with the colonoscopy, you're not going to pick it up. And if you're picking up people that are getting cancer, you know, in the next month, nor is that ideal. Or you know, so this is like really trying to get people in that sweet spot where doing colonoscopy matters. And so this is kind of the reality of the partners that we talked to about the reality of CRC screening. As much as there may be ambition to try to get to every member or everyone within a health system, it's very hard to do that, whether that's going to be capacity constraints or frankly just reticence of people to get screened. So this represents a illustrative 10,000 people. And the people that are in that color purple are those that are going to face CRC in their lifetime. And if we take a kind of random approach, we're likely to kind of, you know, maybe miss a lot of the subjects that are, or people that are likely to have cancer. And we often think about CRC from the lens of the average risk group. And so these are the people that are indicated for screening by USPSTF. And I don't really like the average risk moniker, because I think it actually leads people down a path of complacency, because there are people, even in that average risk group, that have as high or even higher risk than those that are in the known elevated risk group. And so we sometimes call them the unknown elevated risk, because there's going to be some people within that very large cohort, which is the majority of people in any plan, for instance, that are going to be accounting for about 75% of CRC cases. So even though they are average risk or unknown elevated risk, they're accounting for the vast majority of CRC cases. And many organizations, and I'd love to hear some anecdotes about how it's done throughout some of the member organizations represented within HPA, but people do use things to stratify based on their medical history and based on their healthcare utilization. And there's absolutely benefits to that. In fact, I was on a call with someone involved in NHS in the UK this morning, and he was commenting about how crude it is that in CRC for average risk people, all we do is look at age and say, yeah, you're over 45, you're going to get screened. He's like, how we have a national EHR, but yet we're not using anything beyond age to convince people to come in for screening. And so what we're talking about here is a new approach where we could actually predict an individual risk of CRC diagnosis within the next 2 years to allow those patients to be called in and to be contacted to be able to get to their screening sooner and with more likelihood as well. So let's take that kind of illustrative example. And obviously this is just illustrative where, and I don't know how it's done at your organization, but maybe, you know, the first 2,000 get the phone call, or maybe it's alphabetical or zip code or something, but it's likely not informed by a heck of a lot of data and probably no machine learning. And you're going to miss a heck of a lot of cases. Let's turn that on its head now. And if we could actually identify, if we can identify the people that are more likely to benefit, and then focus our outreach efforts on them. And let's say we still only get 2,000 people to come in and get their screening. This is, again, just an illustrative example. We find in this case that we get four times as many people who would have faced CRC in their lifetime and therefore pick up that much more CRC cancer. And so this is really about targeting your outreach efforts and risk stratifying, risk predicting who's going to benefit most from those kind of those interventions, which, you know, are more precious, are more time consuming, and can be more expensive as well. And these are just hypothetical examples. This is Mr. S, a wonderful 52-year-old man who, like, at, you know, at baseline, he had, you know, like many people, unfortunately, including people in my family, you know, lack of urgency for pre-screening. You put it off till you have symptoms. And by the time you have symptoms, you know, the cancer is likely to be metastatic. And then next thing you know, you need, you know, chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitor therapy, and you end up with pretty poor outcomes. In fact, this is a very passionate type of cancer for me, because my grandmother died regrettably of a completely diagnosable cancer. She had rectal cancer and never had a colonoscopy, and frankly, didn't even get a rectal exam, and unfortunately ended up dying of rectal cancer at a fairly young age. So now imagine that we know that Mr. S, based on the data that we received from you know, your individual EHRs, is going to be at much higher risk of having CRC cancer. He gets custom outreach, is encouraged to come in for screening and then gets diagnosed with an earlier precancerous lesion or more something that's more localized and can get away with, hopefully, you know, therapy that's going to be much less toxic, both physically toxic as well as financially toxic. And this is a way to look at the numbers that I just presented as well. If, you know, 10,000 members need to be screened. And I don't want to insinuate here that the only way that you're doing it is random, because I suspect that there's more thought that's being put into it than that. But assuming a random targeted approach, you reach out to 2,000, you know, you get 1 in 2,000 that are going to be diagnosed just based on the prevalence numbers for CRC cancer. However, if we can use risk prediction and figure out, you know, who are the highest risk in that plan, we can then reach out to them specifically and reach 1 in 400 patients who are going to get diagnosed with CRC this year. So huge potential impact to patients and huge potential impact to the health plan as well. So we conducted a study to test our theory. And the way that we did that is we used data. So the NHS in the UK has an incredibly robust set of data. And so these data were captured over, I think it's about 20 million subjects captured over something like 10 years, about close to 900 primary care centers all across, as you can see on the left for the study cohort, England, Scotland, and it's almost 10, it's 9 years there. It's England, Scotland, and Wales, 45 to 85, with a huge number of cases and controls. And then we had a holdout cohort from Northern Ireland, which represented a smaller number, but no overlap. And that's one of the reasons why we did that, no overlap with those in the UK, so that you would minimize bias between the study cohort and the holdout cohort. And what we found, and you know, area under the curve, I sometimes like to explain, although I know this is a technically savvy group, you know, an AUC of 50 basically means that it's a flip of a coin. You know, so anything better than 0.5 is going to be better than a flip of a coin. Generally, anything around 80 point, you know, 0.7, 0.8 starts to get really good. 0.9 and above, it gets to be amazing. What we found in just this first model, not even yet optimized, the first model identified the 50% of the CR cases, 50% of the CRC cases with just 15% of the population. And we've continued to improve on that model. And we now yield an AUC of, as you can see in the call out box on the bottom part of the chart, of 0.804. And while not always true, you can imagine with more data, with more savviness, we can allow this model to get better and better and better at picking up those people, those members, those citizens that are gonna benefit most from early cancer detection. And interestingly, when you actually look at, we call them features, but it's really the different variables that go into the model. We put over 100 features into this model, and a lot of them, like in the multiple dozens, end up being meaningful in that model. And so imagine, like, when you're trying to do a crude model looking at things like just age or just gender or geography, it's really hard to compete with these really large data sets. And then, you know, the use of machine learning as well, which is our approach. And there is a white paper, which perhaps afterwards we can also share with the group if we haven't already. And so a lot of the things that I talked about, we go into a lot more depth there. I already mentioned the area of the curve analysis. In applying this model to an independent set of longitudinal patients, it flagged 80% of the CRC patients at an average of over 2 years before they were actually diagnosed. And again, these numbers are likely to only get better, but the model identified 15% of those who developed 50% of the CRC cases within the screening eligible population. And this is the type of analysis that we'd love to partner with you on, to be able to leverage your actual data, to be able to provide risk prediction that you could then apply in the way that you manage and the way that you outreach to your members. And a question almost always gets asked, and in case it doesn't, I'm gonna mention it right now. Do you tell the member that an analysis of their data demonstrated that they may have a higher risk of CRC cancer? And the short answer to that question is that's up to you. You know, every group it seems to be wanting to take a slightly different approach, but we don't necessarily, you know, this is you dealing with your members. We arm you with the data, and then you decide how you want to use that data with the members, because there's, you know, I think there's arguments on both sides. On the one hand, it could be impactful to tell someone that in fact that this analysis demonstrated that they might be higher risk of cancer, but we also don't want you to be in a position where you're going to unnecessarily scare people or create fear as well. So that's left up to you. And I think those are discussions and decisions that you can make as the primary conduit and the primary interface to your members. We've got a number of people working on this, including some of the names here, everyone with experience in biostatistics, modeling, real world data management, and then of course, also myself on the clinical, and I deal a lot with the FDA on the regulatory side. That's a big part of my job. And I didn't even know we had someone with a PhD in astrophysics, but apparently that's true since it's on the table here as well. So it's just a lot of really neat expertise that we're trying to bring to bear to solve this really challenging but ultimately tractable problem. I'm going to pause for a second here. The last couple slides are a little bit higher level and talking about how we might drive adherence in primary care. But Jennifer, I'll pause for another second to see if there's any comments or any questions.
Sure. There was a question. Who else is in this space? Are there other organizations doing similar risk prediction?
You know, on the risk prediction side, there's limited people doing it with the kind of ambition that we have. On the product side, in other words, trying to bring blood-based tests to patients, to society, there's a number of people doing that. Exact Sciences, who has a Cologuard test right now, is trying to move into the blood space. Garden Health is working on a blood-based test right now. Grail is a company which I kind of alluded to earlier, but I didn't mention, and they're taking a little bit more of the shotgun approach, trying to diagnose dozens of cancers in a single blood test with variable clinical performance. And ultimately, while there are, you know, quote unquote competitors here, you heard Mike Nolan, our CEO, there's a lot of space for people to be successful here. And the ultimate competitor here is cancer. And if we could do anything to either eradicate, ideally, or at least take a big debt out of cancer, there's a lot of space for companies to be successful in this space. And I do want to point out, it's another question that often came up, and I realized I didn't present this well in Reno, because in the sidebars afterwards, the questions were coming up, which were great questions. The current blood test product is not yet on the market.
Right.
We are doing the study right now, pre-MCRC. We're going to be running the validation study next year, and then we'll file something called a PMA, a pre-market authorization. And so it'll be available around 2025. So there's not a quid here about like trying to do risk prediction. And, you know, that's the way to kind of embed the test into these organizations. It's not about that. This is truly about risk prediction and figuring out how we could work together. We could help you to be able to get to the members that are more likely to benefit from screening. And you could help us, because we ultimately gain data, we gain knowledge, we get experience to get better and better at what we're doing. And so it's kind of a mutually beneficial or symbiotic relationship that we're looking for, Jennifer.
Okay, another follow-up question is, you know, once an organization decides to work with you, what's the data intake process like, or what, you know, how much of a burden is that on the plan in terms of providing their data?
Yeah, there's other experts from the company that can chime in here. It's quite bespoke. And so it really depends on the type of EMR that you have,
sure,
the way that we want to work with IT within that organization. So it's quite bespoke. You know, that kind of saying, when you've seen one EMR, you've seen one EMR. And so the reality is we're pretty flexible, and we have to be. Boy, would I love to have a real-time interface where we could, you know, constantly update the risk prediction algorithms and show we can get better. It would be wonderful. But for most organizations, that's not possible. So usually we take a snapshot of data, and we have data elements broken out. So we have a, I'll call it a wish list of data elements. It's everything like, hey, if you can give us these 150, we would, most organizations say, you know, we can't give you that. We can give you these 50, we can give you these 100. That's okay. You know, it's kind of, the more you get, the better we can be, but every organization is different, and it's a heavier lift for some places than others, and that's okay.
Great. Other questions from the group?
Thank you. These are really, really good questions.
Feel free to come off mute if you have a question, or put it in the chat.
I'll continue.
No question, but I'll just real quick say I appreciate you coming out to Reno and sharing with us, and then again today, and offering the clarifications, et cetera, the follow-up.
Great. Yeah. And really, I mean, sincerely, any one-off conversations that you want to have, you know, there's a number of people on this call, which I'll let them introduce themselves later, and they help to, identify these partnerships and do all the things that are just a necessary part of that to work out the terms, get the contracts in place, you know, help set up the data transfers and all. And I've been around the industry, James, for a long time now. I feel like we're pretty easy to work with. We're a relatively small organization, being 500. I used to be at Roche Genentech, 110,000 people. Trying to work with Roche Genentech was pretty challenging. Freenome, we're about 500 people. We can be flexible. That's one of the reasons we're so excited about HPA. We feel like you're kind of in the sweet spot for partnerships for us. I was mentioning to Jennifer earlier, we seem to get pretty good access to the movers and shakers, to decision makers at HPA. And you guys are in kind of a sweet spot from really caring about driving innovation, but also being nimble enough to actually do things relatively quickly that are going to make a difference. And so we just think HPA in general could be a really good group for us to figure out how we could advance some of this technology and some of this innovation, James.
Thank you. I agree. It's pretty cool. Jennifer leads us in the way quite often.
Yeah, so really quickly, primary care, as we know, isn't always, but should be the first touch point for many patients. And why don't patients get screened? Well, there's a lot of different reasons why. You know, certain things culturally, you know, discussing CRC screening can be embarrassing. Some people that say I don't have any family history means I'm not at risk. A lot of people think screening means that's, you know, what I do when I have symptoms. And unfortunately, particularly for those of, you know, even lower socioeconomic class, you can't afford to take a day, sometimes 2 days off work for colonoscopy, kind of dealing with the bowel prep as well as the actual procedure itself. You know, the front line, the primary care physicians are really in a position where they could make more of an impact on adherence. And really what we want to do is give them, you know, more of a target and also more tools as well. And there, you know, as I mentioned, like I used an example earlier of like, you know, random selection of people for outreach. I know in many places it's not completely random, and we try to do things such as manual chart reviews. The problem is information's missing. You spend a lot of time combing through them. You often, you know, have a lot newer patients, and there's really not a lot of data there. And it's more time intensive and less accurate. And the result of this all is that fewer patients end up being screened. And this is where, you know, this idea of risk prediction can help. So that manual chart review now turns into a data dump from your EHR, which then allows us to take that data and generate a model to figure out who's most likely to benefit from screening, either FIT, by the way, or colonoscopy, versus other members within your organization. And then that we can get to you, or you can have yourselves, proactive chase lists and optional interventions that we might want to use as well to save time and gain accuracy. And the result is improved patient care, hopefully, time saved, and ideally a higher HEDIS score as well. And I know Jennifer asked a question at the beginning of this call. We're really interested in not just, you know, as I mentioned, these kind of symbiotic relationships so that you can hopefully get information that's going to make you better at managing your members. But also we learn and we get better in terms of the technological approaches, but we also are interested in improving this. And so being able to work with you to demonstrate improvements in things like outcomes, costs, you know, we'd love to figure out how we can set up that type of thing as well to demonstrate what we're doing. And we do have other things we're building out as well, access to make sure that we could figure that out, social proof, clarity, and then ultimately value. We're working with some behavioral economists right now to figure out how you actually deliver these messages to patients to be able to encourage them to get screened without creating fear, uncertainty, things like that. So just a quick look ahead for driving adherence. CRC, as I mentioned, is the second deadliest cancer in the US. But when it's caught early, the five-year survival rate is 6 times higher. And so we'd love to work with you to figure out how we can get, you know, more targeted in terms of the approach to getting people screened. And this is basically what it looks like. And again, I talked more about EHR data. It can be other data as well, claims data, EHR data, and then ultimately applying our machine learning, risk prediction, our modeling expertise to create these models and this outreach that we can have greater clinical impact together. And by the way, we can take data, not just EHR data or claims data. We can take, you know, either the other or both. So there's ways to actually take data from multiple sources and curate it and then create even better and better models. And I already talked a bit about primary care. I won't cover too much more here, but this idea of taking patient information from those EMRs and some time investment to, again, get to automated review to figure out who's going to benefit from outreach, targeted chase lists, and ultimately data analysis in terms of how we did in that follow-up. Both David, I saw David on the call earlier. I suspect Jackie might be here now. I don't see who's on the screen. And so for risk prediction, Jackie would be your primary contact. She, of course, works closely with me and a lot of us at Freenome. And David, who I had the pleasure of finally meeting in person up in Reno, he'd be your contact here for primary care support as well. Incredibly knowledgeable, and I know well known to HPA as well. And I think that's my last, there's the pictures of them. Yeah, so I think that's my last slide. There's the wonderful pictures of Jackie, David, and myself.
All good.
Pretty good, 252, not too bad, Jennifer. We did okay.
Yeah, you did great. You did great. Thank you. Thank you for the overview. Comments?
I don't know if you want to come on camera, maybe Jackie or David. I know David's here. If you just want to say hi really quick, I'll go on mute and please say hi to the group.
Well, sure. And this is David. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate your participating today. And we're really excited to be able to partner with you as we dig deeper into doing early cancer detection and saving lives and costs. So I know Jackie will introduce herself as well, but look forward to setting follow-up meetings with those of you who are interested to talk about the various ways that we can work together in a mutually beneficial way.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great job, Lance, and nice to see you all again. Thank you guys for joining today. I'm Jackie Moriarty. I'm on the market development team leading these partnerships on risk prediction, and happy to kind of align our internal team and your guys' internal team to partner on this and collaborate. Thank you, guys.
Great. Thank you all. What questions do you have? Any comments or questions for the team while you have them here? Any reflection on what you heard? Anybody on the call want to share how they are currently stratifying and targeting outreach to potential risk for CRC? I'm just curious if that's something that you want to share.
Sorry, I couldn't get off mute a second ago. Did I cut somebody else off?
Nope, you're good, James.
Okay. I'm just curious, like, what kind of interactions does the ordering docs have, or what have you seen in the past, knowing that, like, this isn't fully through, right? Like, it's more in the clinical trial, if you would, state is what I'm hearing anyway. Correct me if I'm wrong, but like, do you get a lot of pushback from docs, or are they like, yeah, let's try this, or, you know, we're going to do this, plus we're going to do a colonoscopy because we still want to follow the, you know, the gold standard there? How's those conversations go?
Lance, you want me to jump in there?
I'll jump in. I could comment on the kind of blood screening side, but if you want to start before that, Jackie, please.
Oh, no, please go ahead. Yeah, go ahead on the screening.
Yeah, no, on the screening test, I mean, I mentioned that the assay is still in development. So right now, the investigators are actually blinded to what's happening. And so people are getting the blood test and then are going out to colonoscopy anyway. So there's no pushback there because it's in the setting of research. As I might have mentioned, I'm in Florida partially now because I was just at ACG in Charlotte, where I was talking to a number of gastroenterologists. And again, not currently available in their screening paradigm, but there's a lot of excitement to be able to offer another option to their patients to be able to say that, you know, they can do this in an easier, more convenient way. Not surprisingly, and there may be a GI doctor on this call, a little bit of pushback from GIs that, you know, their bread and butter is doing colonoscopies. And this is, you know, possibly, you know, might, which I don't think is necessarily true, because I think it's going to get the right people to colonoscopy, you know, but they worry a bit about, like, the impact that it'll have on their kind of bread and butter procedure, screening colonoscopy.
Thank you.
I saw Mashir come on camera. I don't know if you had a question, Mashir, or were you just happy to be on camera?
Hi, Mashir.
Hi, Lance. I've got a culture here at my organization, which is kind of beholden more to NCCN guidelines and kind of following strictly stuff that's done, that's tried and true, and we don't want to be first to market for anything. How would you help me navigate what I want to do in people that are above me?
That's a great question, Mashir. And here's, and I tried to comment on this earlier, but I covered it superficial. I'm gonna go a little bit deeper. I'm loath to tell anyone they shouldn't follow a guideline. So for anyone to go in there and say you shouldn't follow NCCN or you shouldn't follow, you know, the ACG guidelines or USPSTF guidelines for screening, I think is a mistake. And so what we say instead, and this is the way I would position it, is like, hey, listen, we're not being completely adherent to NCCN guidelines. We know that. We're not able to achieve our targets in terms of screening, you know, to achieve the HEDIS score we want. How are we going to do better to be able to leverage our precious resources to make sure that we can get, you know, that screen, those screening tests to the right people? Because we're just simply not getting there right now. So this is not about going around NCCN or going around USPSTF. We're just simply not getting there. And so I try to be careful with that, because I have, and, you know, James asked the question, this is where you will get pushback from doctors, as you're pointing out, Michelle, where it's like, hey, I already know who should be screened on that. It's like, well, yeah, you know, but it's not happening yet. And you could probably show them some data, Michelle. I'm sure you've got some data. If not, we could help you with those data to demonstrate, you know, the number of eligible members who actually aren't getting screened according to NCCN or USPSTF guidelines. And so this is not, to me, an and. This is not saying throw out NCCN guidelines, throw out USPSTF. This is a both. You know, I'm sorry, it's not an or, it's an and. I said that backwards, sorry, but I think you get the point. This is an additivity to the guidelines, not replacing the guidelines.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Reminds me of a Sondheim musical. So for those of you that have seen Into the Woods, you might know what I'm talking about. So Lance, great presentation as always. I was like Mushir was mentioning, I was also curious about the approach when it comes to thinking about the NCQA guidelines and the HEDIS measures. And so I think that's really helpful. As you know, the idea is not to just sort of fulfill these measurements so we can check the box, but there should be some consequential findings. And so perhaps, you know, with the explanation that it is an and, that it's an additive in terms of truly being able to target who's appropriate for the screening, and then having something actionable, perhaps is the approach. Because of course, as a health plan, we are very interested in meeting those metrics, making sure that we fulfill the need there and check all the boxes for the guidelines, not the least of which is screening for colorectal cancer, but only in specific ways, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I think we as a corporate entity would be dead in the water, and I think you'd be dead in the water if we come out and say, you know, this should replace, or, you know, I just think that's...
But maybe someday.
Oh, I think someday, yeah. This is where that call with the former head of, I didn't mention, it was the former head of the NHS, who my call was with earlier today, and he had mentioned, it's so crude, the fact that we're just using age as an input into this. Like, it's just absolutely, you know, versus, you know, models. We have so much data right now, particularly in the UK, we should be looking at hundreds of variables to figure out who's going to be best. I mean, Tracy, I like to make predictions sometimes, but fast forward 10 years, I have a feeling that screening for multiple things is going to be based on these types of models with really robust data sets, and that some of these guidelines are just going to, like, you know, shrink down quite a bit because they're really crude. You know, they're based on, you know, not having access to large data sets, not having machine learning applied to them, and then not customized to you, you know, whether it's UHS or whomever.
Yeah, I mean, and I, you know, I'm a little embarrassed to say, since you've asked the question, how do we sort of risk stratify? We don't. We look at the age. Okay. We say you're a candidate. Go get screened. Yeah. I mean, that's really how we do it.
Shouldn't have any shame in that, because that's it's probably pretty typical.
So this is even better then. You know, it's an easy. It's almost a no-brainer. It's like, well, if we can do better, why wouldn't we?
And I think the point to emphasize is we don't want to just create a tool or a test that still is going to require everybody get screened. It's really about being more precise and really zooming in on who needs it. You know, some of the early tests in the marketplace that are cash pay, you know, they're trying to be kind of a one size fits all and catchment, and let's see what we can find. That's not what we want to do. We want to be as precise, because we know the resources. Even if we had a test that was inexpensive and accessible to everybody, it's just not necessary to be able to zero in on everybody. We want to be able to zero in on those who are at higher risk.
Well, thank you all. I realize we're up on the top of the hour now, and to get a busy group of medical professionals together is never easy. I appreciate taking the time, Jennifer and HPA, for hosting us. And yeah, I hope we get an opportunity with at least some of you to work together.
Yeah, and as always, feel free to reach out to me with any questions. You've got the contact information for the Freenome folks, but if I can help in any way, let me know. And we look forward to continuing to learn with you, Freenome, along the way. And we'll stay together on this journey. So thank you all for joining us today. I'm not sure if Tori's back. She had to do some prep work for next week's board meeting, but there is a survey link. If she's not here to post that, we'll catch you next time. So,
am I allowed to vote for myself, or I can't do that right now?
We'll give you a 10 out of 10. How about that? Right. Thank you all so much, and have a great rest of the day and weekend. And as always, reach out if I can be of any assistance to you.